Welcome to The Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. My guest on the show this week is a touring cyclist, sometime bike messenger, and self-confessed angry young man. 5 years ago, Julian Sayre attempted to set a new record for cycling around the world. At the time, the record was held by Mark Beaumont. You may have seen him on the TV. Sayre had taken a strong dislike to Beaumont and the way his record attempt had been bankrolled by big business. Sayre thought it represented everything that was wrong with the world, and he wanted to beat Beaumont and to take the record back for the people. He's recently written a book about his round-the-world adventure, and I wanted to find out if time had mellowed him, or if he was still just as passionate and worked up as the day he'd set out to beat Beaumont. We met up a few months ago while he was touring the country giving a series of book talks, and you join us on the banks of the River Wye, a few miles downstream from the city of Hereford.
There's not a cloud in the sky, a very clear, almost full moon. The stars are coming out. We're not going to get particularly good stars tonight because the moon is so full, but even so, it's an amazing night, and it's very damp underfoot, and we've got a lot of quite thick couch grass by the looks of it, but I guess the tent pegs are going in easy.
Yeah, they are easy enough, and the river, well, it's not as cold as it could be. There's not too much mist coming off the river. Looks like a good spot for a swim in the morning, and it's a beautiful night, isn't it? It's quite nice travelling around England a bit at the minute, and having been round an awful lot more of the world than the UK, and you can kind of neglect your own backyard a little bit. But yeah, it's beautiful out here.
So we've gathered some twigs from the forest floor. And Julian, now you are assembling them onto this very damp grass in a kind of pyramid. Yeah. Have you got mean firelighting skills?
I'm not bad at it, but we're going to hope for the best. This would be the time where it wouldn't work, obviously, with you and you're in a microphone to verify the letdown. But I'm confident.
Well, Julian, you've lit a tremendous fire. It looks like a work of art. You've got a sort of square form around the edges with the sort of remains of the pyramid in the middle.
Yeah, it's gone really well. I think we'd dry out some of those logs around the edge of it. And it's all damp enough that we're not in danger of it going up in flames too quickly. And, looks quite the textbook campfire at the minute.
Very pro. So now you've just got some onions.
I'm going to put some onions on just on the edge of the embers, really, to let them roast a little in their skins.
Wow.
Which is just one of the things you'll do at a barbecue in Turkey. I'm half Turkish. So, yeah, it's quite a tradition of the roasted onion.
And they won't get burnt.
We'll move them towards the embers as the embers come. The skin will char, and the outer layers will be cooked through, and the inside will be nice and sweet.
Well, look at this. You've got some peppers.
Yeah. I was just going to roast the peppers. Maybe we'll just throw them in a pan and get them cooked quickly, and perhaps in with the sausages a little bit as well.
Yeah, would we do the sausages on a stick, do you think, or is that a recipe for a horrible charred mess?
We could, if we've got a good...
Have you got a good pan?
I got some all right pans.
They are very large sausages.
We can chop them down.
But I think that's good, because if you were to mount them on a stick, you want a large sausage for that, don't you?
Yeah. You want some good purchase, so you don't have your beautiful Hereford finest meat falling either side into the flames and disappearing in a...
That
in
is
a
always
sizzling.
The risk, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've a horrible ashy sizzle. Yeah. Now, I mentioned earlier that you're a round-the-world cyclist, and the last time I had a round the world cyclist on the bike show, which I think was the only time I've had a round the world cyclist on the bike show, was a guy called Al Humphreys, and he took 4 years to ride his bike around the world. You took rather less than that. I mean, you were trying to go round the world, and you succeeded in going around the world in less time than anyone previously had done. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. I mean, it's quite funny. It's about 5 years ago now. But yeah, 5 years ago, I broke the world record for a circumnavigation, which is decreed by Guinness as 18,000 miles. So I rode 18,049 miles in 169 days. All of which is, yeah, I mean, especially as time passes, it comes to feel a little bit of a strange undertaking almost. I'd certainly not counsel anyone to, you know, go out there doing it as fast as that even, and you can certainly miss out on a lot of fun keeping up that pace.
So what's the record now?
The record now is it's gone into the realm of athleticism, really. I mean, I did it at an average of 110 miles a day. The record now is at about 200 miles a day. And I mean, when you're waking up early with the sunrise and going to bed sort of early with soon after sunset, really, there's a lot of hours in the day to cycle the miles. And 110 a day, I managed to have a lot of fun at the same time. Whereas I think I managed 200 miles on about 10 to 15 days. To think of it as an average is, that's a beyond my general capacity as a cyclist.
So you mentioned the onion thing was a Turkish trick, and you're half Turkish. They do love the grilling in Turkish cuisine. It's really, there's a lot of grilling going on, isn't there? Real masters of the grill. I'm seeing that you're displaying your heritage here.
Well, it's something of that, yeah. No, I mean, Turkish food is just fantastic. There's a real, a tendency to just let meat and vegetables taste as themselves, you know, without too great an emphasis on too much seasoning or, you know, too many elaborate marinades, some of which, you know, are wonderful and they are there in the food culture. But, you know, a pepper tastes nice, meat tastes nice, if you just sort of, you know, cook it right and let it show off its flavour a little bit. Mm. That works.
Have you ever been to that place in just off the Kingsland Road, Mangal 2?
Mangal, yeah.
Yeah. Where there's a big grill, a really big long grill in there with an enormously fat man who sits behind it. Very young, but very fat. And it looks to me as though he's kind of like some guy playing a theatre organ. This is a keyboard, and the keys are all long kebabs of meat and vegetables and whole quails. And yeah. And he's turning them. It's like a meat marimba. And he's playing this instrument. And the music that comes out of it is music that you can eat.
Yeah, it is fantastic. I mean, Mangal in Turkish just means barbecue. So there's any number of places on the Kingsland Road called Mangal. And it's really nice, you know, because it is completely Turkish. So for the most part, most of the food you'll find there is as good as that which you find in Istanbul. I mean, I grew up in England, but I've lived in Istanbul sort of on and off subsequently, and so it's a nice way of feeling a little bit, yes, feels a little bit of vicarious home by being in that area. And yeah, the way that they'll run the grill and have everything under complete control every moment,
and that's the thing, you know, there's a lot of concentration going into it, but he's also, you know, interacting with his colleagues, the other staff, and it's just like he's orchestrating this amazing meal for everyone.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of pride Love that it. Goes into it, and a lot of you know, the guy will derive an awful lot of self-worth from doing jobs like that. And it's really nice in Turkey that you know, the sort of service culture and food culture, because food's so important to people there and to society.
You've just come from Ludlow, which is a kind of a gastronomic capital of the Welsh borders. Abergavenny is famous for its food festival. Hereford, I imagine there's good things to eat in Hereford too. There is still food culture, but it's not everyday culture anymore.
Good food has somehow been fetishised, and you know, there are towns and shops where you can get wonderful foods. But I don't know, I suppose maybe people no longer have the time for it in their daily routine, to give it the time it really deserves, to make it themselves. And certainly when you leave the likes of Ludlow, and I've ridden through the Midlands and going along the A47. And it's a lot of Chinese restaurants doing fish and chips and news agents where you can buy a ginster's pasty.
Ginster's?
I thought it was a hard G and a
ginster's.
It might be. Ginster's. That sounds like someone who's really into their gin. He was a real ginster. That's good. I like that. Ginster's or ginster's pasties.
It's not the best.
No, it's not the best.
One way or another.
But probably maybe once upon a time, there was a really lovely little pasty shop that lent its name to the foul, soggy mass that you find in a piece of cellophane in a petrol station.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, whatever you cook, no matter how humble it is, if you're cooking it on a campfire in the open air under the moon with owls hooting in the woods around you, and the knowledge that the River Wye is just flowing along a few yards away. In fact, look at that mist. Mist is rising above the River Wye. Oh, that's fantastic.
What is that?
That's a pheasant.
Ah, really? Yeah, of course.
That's a pheasant. It's that time of year. They're flying all over the place.
They're wonderful, aren't they? They're manic little creatures.
And they sound kind of mechanical.
Yeah.
When they wheel out of the, they sound like they need a good bit of oil.
Yeah.
And they fly up out of the road, out of your way.
And they're always, whatever they do, they're doing it frantically, aren't they? Pheasants always. Yeah, you do occasionally see the roadkill on the road, and sometimes, well, you see lots of roadkill on the road, but in the UK, when you see quite a lot of nice game. I remember being in the US and actually seeing a guy picking a deer up from the highway that was just dead and hauling it into the back of his pickup to take home and butcher. Interestingly, actually, I think the guy that broke my, the very next guy that broke my world record for the circumnavigation, his post-world record outing was to, or one of them was to travel around the UK living for free, including, living off roadkill that he'd found along the way.
Ah, who was that?
His name is Vin Cox. The guy prior to myself had got an awful lot of publicity.
Who was that?
That was Mark Beaumont, and he'd had done it with some big corporate sponsorship and a BBC documentary as well, which I think probably made me and a bunch of other people, such as Vin Cox and also James Beaufort, became aware of the record at that point, I guess.
What motivated you to take on Mark Beaumont's record?
I didn't like the way it had been done. I'd cycled to Istanbul about 3 or 4 times by then. I'd had the most wonderful sort of life-affirming and very human, humble experiences in doing so. And, I was a politics graduate as well, as was Mark Beaumont, actually, and I really didn't like this, this big money and kind of alpha male approach to cycling and cycle touring. The media formula on it as well was to show all that was negative, all that went wrong, how difficult it was. And for sure, it's not the easiest thing in the world to cycle around the world, but, it's a joyful experience. To have, the big business on one side and then a little bit of charity on the other. I guess at the age of 23 or 22, when I first found out about it, I was too irate at all the injustices of the world, and to see my life by bicycle as I'd experienced it sort of being slapped on this same kind of this same sort of formula of business as usual. It was coming out of the credit crunch, financial crisis, and all of that. We'd just bailed out half of these banks, and it all just seemed a bit rich, I suppose.
So you wanted to prove that just a guy on a bike on his own with some determination could do it, and could do it better than all the serried forces of global capitalism, making a celebrity out of another guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Just really down to it.
He wanted to puncture his puncture his balloon.
Yeah, that would be one way of doing it. I think that the funny thing is that, things happen in the media, and until they happen again in the media, it doesn't actually even exist. So there's an awful lot of people who will be thinking still, because they saw it on TV, that Mark Beaumont's 90 miles a day world record is still the world record, even though it's since been broken about six times or more, and the average is up to 200 miles a day.
Well, it's just past midnight. The fire is down to its final embers. We've eaten extremely well, and Julian, you're the master of the grill. If you get extremely fat and move to Dalston, there's going to be a job for you if you want it. Playing the meat organ.
Yeah,
the mangal.
I quite like it out here next to the river, to be honest. There are definitely people in Dalston that fit that role better than I might, I reckon.
So when you were cycling around the world, were you cooking food like this, or were you just kind of eating what you could find on your way, or were you actually cooking for yourself?
I mean, I did actually cycle all the way around the world with a proper camp stove. I had a petrol burning one rather than a gas one, because I anticipated not being able to get the gas canisters. But apart from maybe actually day one or day two in France, where I couldn't find anything open and was not yet used to cycling 100 miles a day, I never cooked for myself once. So I took some essentially fairly heavy kit, 18,000 miles for no reason whatsoever. And for the most part, I mean, boulangeries and what have you in Western Europe, and roadside restaurants in Central Asia, diners in the US. But yeah, because of the record, just keeping on the schedule and not really having time to think too much about what to prepare to eat, that was actually one of the things that made my record. Well, I did it. I went around the world on £5,000. And had a 10 euros a day budget approximately, but had I cooked for myself a bit more, that could probably have been made to go a lot further.
Well, tomorrow we're not going to go far. You've got a date at Ross at the bookshop there, where there's another date on your book tour. But for now, I think the mist is hanging over the water. The moon is still out. We've got a few clouds up above. The owls seem to have gone to bed for the night. They were quite animated a couple of hours ago, but they don't seem to be past midnight owls, and I think it's probably time for us to turn in. So
let the fire go out and hope that the tents are dry.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a damp night on the grass here. I'm glad I'm not in the bivy bag, because I think I'd be infested with slugs by the morning. So I'm going to have a night of luxury in my tent. It's morning, and we awoke to the sound of rain falling on the roofs of our tents, which is quite a nice sound, particularly when you look out of the window and you see in the distance the skies are clearing to the west, as we did. And so it was just a matter of having that little extra lie-in while the rain abated.
Yeah, sometimes it can be a bit of a dangerous waste of time to wait for the rain to stop. And it never does. But yeah, this morning was not one of those occasions.
Well, the River Wye is laid before us. And it looks like we've got a good swimming spot here. There's a couple of rocks that we can easily get down to. It's a little bit too much shade for my liking. Do you think it's time for a dip?
Yeah, I could go for that. Those rocks look like a good launch.
And when did you last have a shower or a bath, Julian? Ooh. Is that too personal a question to ask?
I don't mind. I think I've written enough about it in the book, but it's about 5 days, which isn't really too much of a problem when you're just cycling and on your own. But when you've got to stand, I've been on holiday for the last 5 days, but this evening I have to give a talk, so I don't want to have people standing at a distance from me.
All right, so you're going to get clean in the river.
Bye. Oh, that is cold. Ooh. Woo. Jesus. Well, that's refreshing, huh?
Yeah.
I'm being nibbled by fish.
You've been nibbled by fish?
Yeah.
Really? Piranhas?
I think, once again, Europe is a friendly place.
Stickleback.
Exactly.
A friendly stickleback.
There's an episode of this in Life Cycles, actually. At a spa, I cycled through a coal mining valley and it looked like a chimney sweep just from the amount of residual coal that's in the air. And the next day, I resolved that I had to get clean. And out of nowhere, came across this sign in English in Middle China saying hot spring spa. So I stopped and went in the hot springs, and then they have a pool that's just swarming with fish as well. And the fish, I mean, hundreds and thousands of them. And you just go in there, and I was watching the fish sort of eating the calluses on my hands and the grazes at my, the scabs at my knees and stuff. And that's exactly what's going on there.
Well, I don't know about you, Julian, but I'm feeling like a new man after that swim.
Yeah, definitely. I think the customers at this bookshop are going to be quite grateful for my little jaunt in the river there with a bar of soap.
Now, you take a view, which I don't think a lot of people think about, that you know, a bike ride like this or an adventure like going around the world or all of the kind of wild stuff, outdoor stuff and adventure stuff that it seems to be very much of the moment right now, should be political, for want of a better word. Maybe you should explain what it is that you think is lacking from the kind of current trend and interest in outdoor adventure.
I mean, in as much as I do think it should be political, it's definitely politics with a small p. You know, I think it's the sense that everything's inherently political in some way, and I think more than anything, it would be nice if it was a little bit transformative. You know, in some way that's beyond just potentially a break from the way that we lead our everyday life. I don't know, especially when you start going off around the world, it's, you know, it's all well and good cycling through these wonderful landscapes. But, you know, there's potentially an extraction company that's going to come and sink a bauxite mine into your outback landscape or start drilling for oil or gas in the middle of the Kazakh steppe. And I think, you know, to just enjoy these things, you know, in our own time without thinking that there's a sort of greater political context going on behind it, and that some elements of that sort of corporate drive towards new markets and tapping new resources can sort of endanger the sort of wilderness that we're lucky enough to have. And, you know, the people that help you out, that the poor person that might give you food or give you water when they themselves can't afford that much, it's, I think, one of the great things about travelling at all, but travelling on a bicycle, is the way it brings you in touch with other people. And, you know, I think we have some sort of collective obligation to others, even those that we don't necessarily live beside in our own countries, but everywhere. I mean, you get the expeditions to the North Pole, maybe, sponsored by Range Rover. So you've got, you know, a business producing a car that helps accelerate climate change and destroy the environment that you're adventuring towards. There's some very, very well-educated, affluent, comfortable people undertaking these adventures. It'd just be nice if maybe they could connect that experience to, yeah, I guess, a political setting.
Now, can you think of any examples where that's happened? Where an adventure has had some positive outcome in the way that you describe?
I mean, no, not off the top of my head, I suppose. I suppose, and there is something to be said, that it is equally unavoidably political when you take someone out of their regular context and put them in a different environment that makes them reconsider what they're capable of, or reconsider their daily life.
Or reconsider maybe what's important to them. I mean, a lot of this stuff about, you know, working all week and then going and sleeping in a bivy bag on the Saturday night and having a completely different experience than the day-to-day, I would say that it's very difficult for that not to be in some way transformative, at least at the very personal level, in terms of reordering the things that you prioritise and the things that are important to you. You know, assuming that you enjoy yourself in some way. Obviously, if you hate it and then you come back to your 80 television channels and your microwave dinners, and you think, oh, thank God for that, then obviously it's pushed you back in the other direction. But I think for most people, it's something that makes them maybe reconsider the rat race in a fundamental way, and not just be a bit of light relief that makes the rat race more tolerable. I mean, that seems to be what you're worried about, is that this is just making, it's a sort of escape valve, a pressure valve that allows you to go back to your rat race type of life and endure it more easily.
Yeah, absolutely, that's what would worry me, and I'd be delighted if I'm wrong in that, and I'm sure there are many cases in which I am wrong, where, you know, the archetypal person success story that maybe left their horrible corporate job and went and worked for an NGO having slept a few nights under the stars or something. I'm sure that exists. And yeah, the problem is where it is just a pressure valve that allows you to get on with doing something that is otherwise emotionally unsustainable. I think also just finding your own highest personal well-being from what you're doing is all well and good, but there are an awful lot of jobs, and especially the adventure kind of shtick is very closely marketed towards very corporate businesses, the corporate sector, where there's a lot of refining and maximising human capital and human potential. Further down there, enormous sprawling supply chains, that their business models are negatively impacting on other people who also have a right to, you know, maximise their own personal well-being in this world. And you meet a lot of those people when you cycle through remote places, and they had the same right to that quality of life and comfort. And I think this is coming back to my own record and the record previous to it that made me set out and want to take it back, was you know, traded quite heavily on these, you know, wonderful wholesome images of the, you know, the common man and the salt of the earth poor person around the world, who's maybe a farmer or who's maybe a tribesman, and you know, whether we can see it visibly or not, a Western economy does impact on those ways of life, because it will set down a bauxite mine, or it will have an agricultural commodities fund. And I think these things are connected. You know, we have such massive availability of information via the internet or connectivity. It's almost a bit lazy to not see ourselves as part of that slightly bigger picture. It's really interesting that, I suppose, yeah, it's so easily dismissed as being kind of woolly or leftist or something to articulate these kind of sentiments, which is probably a problem in itself.
Well, how do you, on a day-to-day basis, live a life that has less of the negative impacts that you've talked about? Do you live that sort of a life, do you think?
I mean, it's very hard to live the moral life. I'm sure I try to shop at a cooperative, even if it's more expensive. Where I can, I try to buy ethical kit. I try to buy cycling gear in particular from smaller companies. But absolutely, it's hard. And that's actually where politics comes into it as well, because there are certain things that you know, could be legislated against and regulated against so that the decision is taken out of the hands of the everyday person who's actually just trying to go about buying their lunch or what have you. And I mean, this is where it gets it's hard to say there's any strong link between adventure travel on a bicycle and abolishing agricultural commodities funds. But I think that sort of consciousness of other people and maybe injustices can travel together.
You think that the bicycle has some lessons in it for how we might live our lives off the bicycle, that there are aspects to the way that the bicycle works that are instructive?
Yeah, absolutely. There are sort of idioms about a place, you know, it's more about the journey than the destination in life or what have you, and the bicycle definitely brings that sort of thing out. The fact that, when you set out in France cycling for Shanghai, you're not going to get there quickly. You need to learn to be patient and just enjoy life as it comes to you along the road. And then, I mean, that's empowering, and the fact that actually with, you know, a small Allen key cluster in your legs, you can cross the Eurasian landmass from Normandy across to Shanghai in, well, in my experience of my outing, under 3 months. That's empowering. It reminds you what we're capable of, and absolutely it pulls you into contact with the people that you meet along the road, which is incredibly valuable because so much of our daily life, and you know, behind windscreens, computer screens, television screens, isolates us from one another. And humans, I think, generally do better where they are connected to one another and where they're connected to people that are from a different walk of life to the one they've experienced. It's also just deviant. I mean, in sort of social enterprise jargon, disruption is the buzzword at the minute, but the bicycle is kind of transport disruption after a fashion. And
really? I don't know. I don't feel like I disrupt many people when I'm on my bike.
Well,
I feel like I get quite disrupted by the juggernauts, lorries and white van man.
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely relate to that. But in a sort of transport model, which is fundamentally based around combustion engines, the bicycle is this really efficient and human-powered alternative. Is a different way of doing things. I mean, that's how I mean, really, when I use the word disruption. It's a different way of doing things. And I think in our politics, in our daily life, it's quite healthy to be shown that kind of context of you know, just the existence of alternatives. I think that's a healthy thing.
Well, the alternative that faces you now, Julian, is how to get to Ross-on-Wye. Which bank of the Wye do you want to travel on? You can carry on this bank, which is quite a nice lanes route, or you can cross over this footbridge, Selick Bridge, past the little church, onto the other side. But it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Likewise. Looks like there's some sunshine on this bank at the minute, so I might stick with it.
Yeah, I think we've guaranteed a quite a nice sunny day for the rest of the day. And so what next?
What next? My second book should be London as a Bicycle Messenger. So the first book is The World on a Bicycle. The second book, which the manuscript's now finished, is London from the Bicycle. I've done quite a lot of hitchhiking in the last year. So another book of hitchhiking, New York, San Francisco. I've started working on some documentary projects, and taking, in particular one, taking youngsters from different backgrounds, cycling from... we did a little documentary of riding London down to Brighton last year to see how it would work. It went really well. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, I'm sure there'll be bicycles and writing involved in it, whatever it is.
I was riding with Julian Sayre. His book, Life Cycles, is published by John Blake and available in paperback and on the Kindle. Thanks for listening to The Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. Until next week, goodbye.